07-1019, PC Finance.
Proceed with our work. Draft Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. We've taken submissions from a number of people. We proceed today with those
amendment bill is presented on behalf of organized business via the Business Parliamentary Office. The BPO, as you know, comprises the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, formerly SACOB. We also comprise BUSA, Business Unity South Africa, Chambers of Commerce and Industry South Africa, the Afrikaanse Handels Instituut, NAFCOC, and Federation of African Business and Consumer Services, FABCOS. Through the active support and involvement of all of these business formations, the mission of the BPO is to provide a centralized forum for input from organized business to Parliament. Organized business has considered the 2007 Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. The commentary contained in our submission here today covers the following five areas contained in the bill around which organized business would like to make its views heard through these hearings. The areas include secondary tax on companies, including the issue of dividends, intellectual property, capital contributions, environmental deductions. The process of consolidating the submission was coordinated through the efforts of the joint BUSA-SACI Taxation Committee. The commentary on environmental deductions has particularly accommodated the concerns of the Chemical and Allied Industries Association, whose overall convener participates within this taxation committee and the structures of BUSA. Through this, we believe we're contributing to ongoing efforts to strengthen environmental stewardship and a focus on the triple bottom line within organized business. We've had sight of the commentary by other interested parties, whose submissions deal with some of the aforementioned areas in a lot more significant detail. With due respect for the time constraints of the committee chairperson, we've crafted our submission to succinctly narrow in on the most pertinent concerns identified by organized business, without diluting the importance of providing the committee with sufficient details to ensure appropriate depth of understanding around these concerns. In so doing, we've collaborated with the legal firm Malenix Incorporated to assist us in elaborating on the technical nature of the issues covered in our submission. In this regard, our delegation includes Mr. Des Kruger, tax specialist and head of tax at this legal outfit. Mr. Kruger is also a former convener of the BUSA-SACI Taxation Committee. Malenix, who will also lead evidence today, is represented by Mr. Investor, sitting on my far left. Through this collaboration and by virtue of the broad spectrum of organized business serviced by the BPO, the submission by the BPO before the committee ensures legitimacy and sound technical acumen of the complex nature of the revenue law amendments being proposed as it affects business on the ground. In concluding, Chairperson, in the 2007 budget review of the National Treasury and the 2007 budget statement by the Minister of Finance, the broad underpinnings of the 2007 tax year proposals were articulated as aiming to provide further support for economic growth, investment, and South Africa's attractiveness as an investment destination, job creation, business development, and business confidence. In legitimately representing the broader spectrum of business in South Africa, organized business hopes that the commentary contained in the submission before the committee today will be understood and considered within the context of our commitment to support and contribute to the achievement of these strategic economic objectives, which we firmly committed to and share the collective responsibility. The complex nature of some of the revenue law amendments focused on in our submission underscores the importance of a robust and vibrant interaction between organized business and the committee through these hearings, and ensuring a sufficient depth of understanding around the concerns of organized business. We therefore welcome the opportunity to make submission today as part of an open ethos approach that will contribute to strengthening parliamentary democracy. I'll now hand over to Mr. Des Kruger, who will elaborate on the technical aspects of our submission. And once Mr. Kruger is completed, I think he will hand it over to Mr. Investor of Malenix, who will deal specifically with the submission made by Malenix.
Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning to present the BUSA-SACI presentation regarding the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill. As Mr. Bell mentioned, and certainly having had a look at some of the other representations that have been made to this Honourable Committee, we certainly have not gone into great detail about the actual wording of the bill, etc. And really what we've tried to do is highlight some of the more important issues that business has highlighted as a major concern. And I suppose if one looks at it and steps back, I think some of the concerns we have in general terms is that what we're seeing is specific anti-avoidance provisions being introduced, which with respect seems to attack genuine transactions as well. And that's the nature of specific anti-avoidance provisions, is that they do then tend to paint all transactions with the same avoidance brush. We have a new general anti-avoidance rule that has been introduced recently, and that clearly is a rule that will target specific anti-avoidance transactions. And what we'd like to say at the outset is that our concern is that we're seeing more and more anti-specific legislation where perhaps we should be relying on the general anti-avoidance provision. Because as I have to highlight as we deal with some of these issues, some of them do affect genuine transactions. The first starting point I noticed that it has been raised by a number of other parties as well, so I'm just repeating really what I know a number of people have said. It relates to the secondary tax on companies and the fact that the exemption in relation to pre-1993 revenue profits and 1 October capital profits on the winding up or liquidation of a company is unfortunately retrospective in nature, in the sense that at the time that the SEC was introduced in 1993, it stood back and said, okay, well, to the extent that you have profits that have arisen prior to that date, we're not going to impose SEC. Which is the correct way with respect that we want to go forward if you are introducing legislation, is that you don't go back and affect transactions that have taken place before. Similarly, in relation to capital profits and capital gains tax was introduced, it was a case of, okay, to the extent that the capital profit that you derive, which is now going to be subject to SEC, which wasn't always subject to SEC, but to the extent that the capital profit relates to the period before 1 October 2001, under those circumstances, we won't impose SEC. What is intended now is those two exemptions or exclusions will now fall away and therefore will become subject to SEC on winding up and on liquidation. Now, it's all very well to sit back and say, well, you've got quite a significant amount of time before this new legislation comes in, so there's more than enough time to clear out the companies or liquidate or wind up the companies that you want to. I think it's fair to take into account that business doesn't operate on that basis, that we're now sitting back and saying, oh, this legislation is changing, let's see who we can liquidate or can't. That transpires over time, and invariably what's going to happen is something will happen later on or closer to the cutoff period, and then we're going to have a situation where that these provisions will in fact become effective. It also means that those who can arrange their affairs prior to the implementation date will do so, and those who can't or whose situation changes after that date will be, in fact, subject to this new provision. I fail to understand how this legislation cannot be regarded as retrospective. And effectively, I know the minister at the time said that the quid pro quo was the reduction in rate to 10%, but the fact of the matter is, when we were looking at it, we certainly accepted that there would be a broadening of the base going forward, but this, with respect, looks backwards as well. And with all due respect, I think it's unacceptable from a point of view of policy that we now have retrospective legislation of this nature. A similar problem, and I might just add in relation to secondary tax on companies, although we haven't dealt with it yet, is we would urge National Treasury or the Revenue Service to put something out to clarify the position around the fact of the change to 10%. What we have is an untenable position that we have draft legislation that provides for the 10% change in rate, but if anybody's declaring a dividend at this point in time, that legislation is not effective yet, so strictly speaking, 12.5% tax must be paid. Now, we understand that the legislation will be made effective to backdated to the 1st of October, but I think there needs to be some clarity for business as regards the 10% and how otherwise people should account for it. That is one thing that business regularly, we're on the phone to them at the moment, people saying to us, where's the legislation? We say, well, it's not been passed by Parliament yet. It's supposed to be passed by Parliament. We need some, as we had recently about the apparent conflicts in effective dates on some of the SEC legislation, where we start to put out a note. We need a note on the 10%. And that it is acceptable at this point in time, notwithstanding that we do not have legislation at 10%, that people can, in fact, account for SEC at 10%. Right, then in relation to the next issue about the dividend and the capital profits, it's actually the position I've already raised in relation to the secondary tax on company, which is a similar situation, and on that basis, we would raise the same thing. Now, the further one that is of concern to us is the further amendment to the definition of dividend, which really effectively seeks to apportion share capital, that share premium, based on the market value of the shares at the time that the distribution is made. Now, we are more than aware that of SARS's concern and National Treasury's concern about the avoidance, or if one can call it that has taken place around what I call capital distributions, and we'll come to that in a minute, where effectively, instead of declaring dividends, we have a situation where share capital is returned to shareholders. And unfortunately, we also are aware of the fact that there are circumstances where transactions have been entered into whereby they've utilized the share capital to effectively dispose of shares by making capital distribution to only one shareholder and not pro rata in relation to the other shareholders. So we understand we understand the mischief. But once again, my concern is that we have a specific anti-avoidance provision that effectively will affect and attack legitimate schemes. And we gave a short example there where effectively you could have a situation where share capital is introduced over time, different people introducing different amounts of share premium or share capital. For instance, I could have subscribed for a share today for 1 rand and a premium of 9 rand. Henny comes in a little while later and he subscribes for shares, but now of course the value of the company has increased, so he now subscribes for 1 rand share at a premium of 20 rand. If we then return capital pro rata, what's going to happen is that effectively Henny's return, part of his return, which was share capital when he put it in, will be regarded as a dividend subject to SDC, which doesn't make sense. So these sort of practical issues is one of the things, as I say, and there's no avoidance involved or anything like that. The fact of the matter is, different shareholders put in share premium and share capital at different points in time with different amounts. And so, as I say, our concern is we have a specific anti-avoidance provision here where we should be saying, if you are using your share capital to enter into a transaction that avoids tax, but of course you are not distributing all the share capital to one shareholder, right, then we should be applying the general anti-avoidance rule. Let's not be scared to apply the general anti-avoidance rule. As we know, this committee spent a lot of hours, and we spent a lot of hours with you, going through that new general anti-avoidance rule, and perhaps it's time we applied it. So our concern is that, once again, the specific anti-avoidance provision will affect legitimate transactions. There's also been a lot around intellectual properties and this new concept of effective intellectual property. As has been stated by so many other people as well, in our sense, we have a disincentive to develop effectively in South Africa where there's connected parties. So if we have somebody sitting overseas, a head office or something like that, who wants the stuff to be developed here in South Africa, but it obviously belongs to the offshore entity, who will obviously charge the local South African entity for the right of use of that, then once again we're going to be adversely affected by this transaction. Whereas effectively, we know that what this is aimed at is a situation where the guys dispose of the intellectual property to a tax haven, let's put it a tax haven, and then that tax haven charges them a royalty. We have a withholding tax on royalties in South Africa. We don't have double tax agreements with tax havens as such and that sort of thing. So maybe this is overstated in the sense that we're concerned that if we dispose of South African intellectual property, which we then use and then pay a royalty for, that somehow we have some huge tax leakage. Provided that when we sell off the intellectual property and there's proper valuations done and that sort of stuff, it shouldn't concern us. And in relation to the amount that's charged us by royalties, we've got two things that assist us. We've got a withholding tax on royalties, where we don't have a double tax agreement, which reduces it. And the other thing is we have transfer pricing. So once again, we've seen specific anti-avoidance provisions because, in our view, the perceived inability to actually administer the law that's there in terms of general anti-avoidance rule, in terms of royalty withholding, and in terms of transfer pricing. So once again, we would urge you to reconsider the introduction of that provision. Now, I've already touched upon item 2.4 in our submission, which is this question about capital distributions, where effectively the way the law reads at the moment, if I return capital to you, that it doesn't trigger any immediate CGT because there's been no disposal. But what happens is when you dispose of that share sometime in the future, any return of capital to you gets added to proceeds and you pay capital gains tax on that. That's the rule as it is at the moment prior to the amendment. Now, clearly that provides for a deferral. And one would have thought that at the time it was entered into, that was given consideration to. Clearly, Revenue and National Treasury are concerned that in many respects it could be a total deferral because I might hang on to those shares forever and a day. My concern would be if I was National Treasury and SARS is, and I've seen it, we have a number of listed companies who have made capital distributions to shareholders who have no idea, with all due respect, no idea that what they've received is a capital distribution that must be added to the proceeds when they dispose of this other thing. How many of you sitting on the table who may have bid their shares know that they did a capital distribution? And any number of other listed companies have made capital distributions. So I see an administrative problem, and I think from a business point of view, we do not have a concern that SARS would like to trigger it earlier and thereby making sure that I, as an individual, know that when I receive the capital distribution, I've got to pay CGT, not someday in the future where I don't know, and SARS certainly won't know that what I've received was capital distribution. So we do not have a concern with the proposed change. And we understand where it comes from. We understand what is the necessity for it. Our concern is the fact that we have had the situation that since 2001, we've had a regime where capital distributions have been made on the basis that there is a deferral. What is proposed now, effectively, is once again retrospective legislation that says, notwithstanding that there was this deferral at the time that was the distributions were made, we want you to now trigger a liability in respect of all those capital profits that were distributed sometime in the past at the time when there was deferral. So once again, while we accept that there is a good basis for bringing in this provision, we are concerned about the retrospective nature of it. So that when at the time I received my proceeds, if I was a knowledgeable taxpayer and I knew that it was capital profits and that I didn't have any capital gains tax, I might have made plans, I might not have the cash today and that sort of stuff. With all due respect, I think we must go forward, and to the extent we believe it was an avoidance thing in part, let's apply the rules. As regards to environmental deductions, we welcome these environmental deductions for rehabilitation and protection. The only thing we would say is that generally a 5% rate is over a 20-year straight line is unrealistic given the fact that these things do not endure for that amount of period. It's not as if in 20 years' time necessarily that rehabilitation or whatever is going to be around or we're going to be around in relation to it. So what we would submit for your consideration is increasing the rate to 10%. I'd like to now hand over to my colleague Jenny Vesper, who will probably elaborate on some of the points we've raised here and some of the other points that we as Melanex have raised with National Treasury and SARS. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm talking to the submission that Melanex made, dated 8 October 2007. I'm just going to highlight certain points there. I'm not going to go through everything. It's the either written submission and discuss certain points that I want to lift out. Just as a first theme, being in a law firm where you've got...
The submission he's talking to is the submission that was in the members' pack with the NPO submission.
It's got a little triangle in the top right hand corner.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the point I want to make. Being in a law firm where you straddle pure legal advice and tax advice at the same time is sometimes there's a concern when you see legislation coming up from SARS which reflects the understanding of company law which is not consistent with the understanding that a company lawyer will have. And I'll highlight some of that. It's not really important points, but it's just a general observation that sometimes SARS, and it's in the first submission, in the first paragraph of the submission, you will see, for example, in the explanatory memorandum, SARS say, and it's important to read the explanatory memorandum because it explains what the understanding of SARS of the problem is and what the legal position is as background to the actual legislation that's being proposed. SARS say in the explanatory memorandum that in a particular amendment that the law technically excludes distributions of share premium from the dividend definition, but is silent as to share capital. Now, that's just a difficult point to understand from a company law point of view, because when you issue a share, typically What you pay for that share, your subscription price consists of two components. It's the par value of that share, and that's in your memo and article that says the shares of the company are as follows. That's your authorized share capital. And when you issue the shares, you pay for those shares, and what you pay for is the par value, and anything in addition to the par value is what they call share premium. But both those amounts are actually share capital. So it's just difficult to understand in itself that, you know, share capitals are being dealt with. Both share premium and par value is components of share capital. So we elaborate on that point there. On the same theme, SAR says that no difference should exist between the removal of funds from a company in these circumstances, and it's set out in paragraph 1.6, 1.7, where we quote from the explanatory memorandum, the removal of funds as either by way of reduction of your share premium and your par value. And we say, well, if you look at the company value, there's a big distinction between your company's issued share capital, which consists of your share premium account on the one hand, which is the premium that you've paid in all the shares that you've subscribed for, and your par value. And it just causes a bit of difficulty if they all lump together. There is a difference between those two. And even though your par value may be very small, it's an important concept in company law. And it's just we highlight the difficulty there. I'm not going to repeat all the points that have been made about retrospective or apparently retrospective legislation. We address that also. The removal of the exclusion of profits of a capital nature and before 1 October 2001. Our submission is, as with the others, that this amendment to the dividend definition to remove the exclusion of profits of a capital nature and before 1 October 2001 effectively introduces a tax on profits earned or accrued prior to the introduction of SDC and CDT. And is that a retrospective application, and we are strongly opposed to this adoption. I think it's accepted that SARS can identify tax avoidance and tax anomalies in the tax system and deal with those, but I mean it's a basic principle of all legislation that you can't, it causes a whole lot of problems that you have a change of legislation which affects this position of the legal reality that applied in the past. Plus, in avoidance schemes, my clients often ask me whether we can backdate agreements, and then the hair on the back starts to rise, but it's the same concept. But you can't really backdate an agreement. You can't travel back in time and change reality. What you can do is you can enter into an agreement now and have it with retrospective effect as far as the two parties are concerned. But to say to the population out there that the law is different than you had in the past, it just goes against a whole lot of, and it's not even tax principles, these are principles of good governance. So there's a major issue with having retrospectivity of legislation. Now the other issue that we've highlighted, and it's on the same theme that I've got here, is when you understand legal concepts, purely legal concepts, and how they tie with tax, and I think this is one where SARS would agree with us. You've got a whole lot of inclusions in the definition of company. Now, that's very important because once you're a company, you're deemed to be a company for tax purposes. It's got all sorts of consequences. It means that company is a taxpayer in its own right. It means that the distributions or payments made by that company would be regarded as dividends. And there's a whole range of implications. Now, in South Africa, we've got a law called the Collective Investment Schemes Act, which regulates your old unit trust type of structures. But these are legal structures based on a trust, sometimes a partnership, which are regarded as what they call fiscally transparent. All that means is that the tax consequences flowing through these structures are attributed to the members of that fund. Now, it's not a problem in itself to deem a collective investment scheme to be a company, but then you've got to be consistent. And we highlighted situations where a collective investment scheme may be a trust, which is tax transparent, but now it's deemed to be a company. Therefore, when you make a distribution from that collective investment scheme, it should be a dividend. Now, some of the changes, and we highlight that, I'm not going to go into the technical detail, seem to exclude those distributions from the dividend definition, which is going to cause some issues, because you'd like consistency right through the legislation. We also have some comments on the proposed changes to the definition of dividend, where you deal with where shares have been issued for different subscription prices at various stages. And once again, every time a share is issued, there could be a different subscription price. I mean, you could issue a share on day one for 1 rand, Barbadi is 10 cents and your share premium is 90 cents, and then the company might do something great, be a very valuable company, and a year later it will be at 1,000 rand, your share premium is still at 10 cents. Now, it's been highlighted by my colleague here, Kruger, the problem is that the actual share premium at the time of issue will vary over time, but these provisions now seem to just spread it regardless, and I think it's just a bit of acknowledgement of the reality of corporate life to have it that way, and it causes great problems. There's an amendment dealing with Section 8C, specifically dealing with share phantom schemes. We don't think that amendment is necessary. I think share phantom schemes is just a fancy word for a way of calculating a bonus. There are no actual shares being issued, and that's already covered by the general principles of taxation. A share phantom scheme would be where you would say to your employee, instead of me issuing a share to you, which you can then maybe on-sell at the stock market, or we'll buy back from you at an increased price, and you get the incentive of trying to increase the equity in the company, we're going to simulate that whole situation. But what you're actually going to get is just a cash payment. We're going to do a contract for difference effectively. We're going to look at the value of the company now and the value of the company later, and simulate that if you had a share, if we bought that share back from you, and that profit we're going to pay to you. Now, that is already covered by general legislation, doesn't need specific legislation under the share incentive provisions, or the share scheme, the actual share scheme provisions, which is your provisions from Section 8C. There's another issue that it's a very helpful, or it's a helpful provision, an amendment to Section 9C of the Act, which is a provision that deals with the interaction between the deemed disposal rules for trading stock, but there is no concomitant rule that deals with the situation where a taxpayer acquired a share and held it as trading stock and at a later date decides to hold it as a share on capital account. It deals with a situation where you've got a share on capital account. Very important is when you sell it, you're going to make a capital gain and not only income, and then you change your intention and there's a tax consequence, but it doesn't deal with the reverse situation. And I think there are conceivable situations where you're going to have that reverse situation. Then just on the intellectual property, just a general observation, there is a government policy of foreign direct investment encouragement and the development of intellectual property. And there's also the very strong arm of exchange control on intellectual property issues. There's a blanket ban. If a South African company legitimately sets up an offshore structure and wishes to sell its intellectual property in South Africa to an offshore structure, the Reserve Bank would not allow it. Now, that is prohibited under the general prohibition against the export of capital. But I think there are situations where, for example, I'm not going into intellectual property detail, but the use of a trademark in a particular jurisdiction for a subsidiary in that jurisdiction will be more advantageous than having that trademark registered for that jurisdiction in South Africa. There may be treaty issues. So when you look at intellectual property, there's a very strong, and we deal with clients every day, I'm not talking about the people who want to really export capital and get rid of the intellectual property because they don't want to earn income into South Africa. That's a problem in all jurisdictions. But I'm talking about the use of intellectual property for genuine global expansion. It's almost like an iron jacket being imposed from exchange control perspective. And I think it will be very good if we could look at this policy at some point, align it with our tax policy and align it with our investment encouragement policies, and have something that works actually for people in the intellectual property development sphere. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the only other point that I have is going to be a repetition of what you've heard before, and I'm not going to do that. It's just going to waste your time. That's basic submission from my side. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In fact, we're very well on time, and if members could also assist in making sure that we stay with them. Any questions of clarity? Mr. Patel, do you want to make some?
Not a question, Chairperson, just a point of clarity. I've been asked to point out page 4 of the BPO submission, point 2.1, secondary tax on companies. The first line should read, the deletion of the exemption of pre-1993 revenue profits, not pre-2001. I do apologize for the omission.
Okay. Even though I would want to submit that there are quite a lot of similarities from the other submissions that we actually have had. We just seem to be amplifying exactly what the previous submissions. I hope that makes the work for SARS and National Treasury very easy in responding, because they will be responding to issues that cut across a number of the submissions. The issue of retrospectivity, the issue of the blade lines, SIMCAR, and what we're proposing, and the issue of the treatment of declared dividends prior to the 1st October as against the background of the change from 12.5% to 10%, and also the change to treatment of it as dividends. But questions from members? But also an interesting point I wanted to check, on page, is it the same? Yeah, on the same page 4. The issue of retrospectivity arises there, but also a recommendation of some backdating comes up. Is backdating and retrospectivity not, some backdating seems to be favorable in another, but some retrospectivity is problematic in another form. I know it's not entirely, with the same results and effect, but it's rather very interesting.
I'll try and answer that, and my colleague can add to that.
Can we take the other questions? Is there any other questions? Just note that it's a very small question, but okay. Is there any other hands? Can I take Mr. Singh and Mr. Mguni?
Thank you, Chair. I think you're quite correct. There's no similarities in the presentation by different people, except for this emergence of environmental deductions. I don't think we've heard that one before from anybody else. And you make quite an interesting submission there. But what we'd like maybe just for our own information is for you to unpack this. Because he used some perfect examples. Wastewater dams, reservoirs, pumps, filtration plants. But where does one draw the line in terms of identifying the items that you are pleading for a 10%, the rate to be amended to 10%?
Thanks, Mr.
Mguni.
Thanks, Chair. It's also on page 4 on retrospectivity. My question is the difficulty you have, is that going to be too cumbersome, or financially it's going to be too demanding? Your peers, when you talk about retrospectivity. And then on the page 4 on the dividends, second paragraph, where you say where there are two shares. And I think that the value of a share is not an appropriate basis, given blah, 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 blah. What is the appropriate basis in your view? And the last one, Chair, on page 5, intellectual property. I think that certain provisions relating to the foreign exchange control. I just want to say, what are those provisions that are there, which might put you in a disadvantage? And lastly, and also on these environmental deductions, why do you want 10%, not 15% or 8%, but you stated at 10%? Did you come with any evaluation or assessment saying 10% is appropriate?
Maria?
Thank you, Chair. My question or concern that I'm picking up is also mentioned on page 3 of the business parliamentary unit their submission, and it refers to the expectation or apparent expectation that has arose from the Minister of Finance budget statement in terms of economic growth, job creation, development of the Zaire economy, and what this proposed legislation might do to that, and also in terms of retrospectivity. And what I got from my impression from all three gentlemen and the other day as well, is that this will not be advantageous to foreign direct investment. And obviously that is something that we have identified, that the minister has identified, that we need in South Africa. Now, your opinion, I mean, what effect will this and might this have on foreign companies that is already in South Africa, and also on foreign companies that has had the objective in the past to look at South Africa as an alternative in the emerging markets to come and invest here in terms of foreign direct investment. Because I mean, we know that in terms of the deficit on our balance of payments, we know that is increasing, and one of the ways that we can change that is by increasing foreign direct investment. And I think this is in my mind, a critical element of future growth of our economy in a sustainable way. And I just want to look at more a practical situation of current foreign investors and potential foreign investors, and what that might do or can harm or not harm the economy as such. And obviously that is some of the broader perspectives and the pictures that we have to look for. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Phipps.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just on two of the points that have been made. There has just been a reference on page 3 of Melanex, I think it is, referring to the removal of exclusion of profits of a capital nature earned before this period. And it notes that one of the reasons for the introduction of the pre-effective date exclusion was to avoid subjecting tax in the hands of a company amounts earned or accrued before the introduction of a secondary tax, etc. Now, what I'm trying to understand is the concern that you're raising here in bold, that you believe that the amendment to the dividend definition has somehow created the problem, the actual definition itself. Perhaps, I know you were trying to explain it to us, but perhaps you could do so again for my benefit. And the other thing is on the intellectual properties, which we have heard quite a lot about in other submissions, but for me it's quite it would be of interest to hear your own understanding of this with respect to certain R&D within the country, but without the results of such R&D being used in the home country, but then transferred across to an external or foreign company. In other words, before it's used, it's purely on paper, but of course it's all been proven, etc. And then that same, having sold that, in fact just transferred it, not even sold it, that the foreign holding company, if you like, then begins to sell that back to us at a profit for themselves in the external country. Now, we would not have made anything on this by way of tax, by way of anything, perhaps other than having employed the researcher. Thank you.
Okay, can we take quick responses to those? We would want to move quite speedily to the next. Ms. Makota. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll deal with some of them, and then my colleague will deal.
There's just one last question. My apologies. Ms. Makota, quick.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question of clarity on the comment you made when you started the presentation. You talked about the anti-avoidance provision brought in by SARS undermining the genuine transactions I want you to explain that, because I don't know why is it that you have that impression, because I think that all genuine transactions really do need to be taxed as well. And then maybe you can explain to me as well what transactions are deemed genuine and which ones are not deemed genuine. Thanks, Chuck.
Okay, let's then get responses.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also just indicate that the Chairperson of the BPO Advisory Board, Advocate Mailing, has just arrived. So if there is anything specific in terms of the submission which we've made, which he's seen, I would also just want him to have the opportunity to speak to any specific questions that the House may have. If I can start, Chairperson, just responding to some of the concerns raised by members. Page 3 of the submission, where there was a question relating to the broad underpinnings of the 2007 tax year proposals. I think the rationale for putting this in the submission, and I think the statements made by colleagues in the delegation are quite clear, that as organized business, these broad underpinnings are supported. It's good for the country, it's good for growth, it's good for business. I think the question then comes in terms of the current tax proposals, and the specific ones highlighted in the submission by organized businesses, how those are administered, how they are applied, and I think my colleague, Mr. Kruger, raised that point repeatedly when he dealt with some of the thorny issues around the secondary tax on companies and also the intellectual property amendments. So I don't think it's a sticking point. I think what we're saying is we support these broad underpinnings. The manner in which it is administered and the impact that that has for business on the ground is the real litmus test. If I can just pick up on the issue of environmental deductions, I indicated in my introduction that the commentary via the BPO submission on the specific issue was usually informed by the comments by the Chemical and Allied Industry Association, who is affiliated to BUSA, whose convener is also part of the joint BUSA-SACI Taxation Committee. I think what's important here is that in line with global trends, strong environmental and sustainable development stewardship by the corporate sector, by business, is very important. I think what we're seeing introduced now in terms of tax provisions also builds on what's in place in other legislation like the Environmental Management Act, which have far-reaching implications for businesses in the way that they deal with the impact of economic production on the environment. The issue here, in relation to your question around the 10%, Member Singh, and I think Mr. Murray raised similar concerns, is we were trying to make an example that clearly the nature of the asset being spoken about will determine the percentage of allowance. Some of these assets are big ticket items, things like dam, major wastewater treatment plants. You're talking about significant infrastructure here. The experiences of municipalities in South Africa can attest to the challenges associated with the financial management of these infrastructure. So the 10%, it's an example that we've made. We're not saying it must be that. We've used it as an example, and I think the wording in the submission is quite clear. We say wastewater treatment plants, filtration infrastructure, etc. So it's not limited to that specific issue. We're merely raising the point that it needs consideration. But again, business welcomes this. It's in line with strong environmental stewardship from within the corporate sector. I'll hand over to Mr. Bester to talk about some of the FDI issues. I think in his specific commentary by Malenich, he spoke extensively about the FDI challenges associated with intellectual property, also how that is aligned with the current policy disposition of government around attracting foreign investment.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not an intellectual property expert. From my understanding is that there's a technical difference between intellectual property as patent, as design, and as trademark. I acknowledge the principle given by the member, the honourable member, about the true export of capital. The example would be a South African company developing software, valuable software, and then set up an offshore trust, and then sell the software, or simply make the software available for the offshore trust without any quid pro quo for that, and then let all the income from the worldwide licensing of that software in a crew offshore outside of the South African tax section, outside of the South African exchange control net, and they all do the work here in South Africa. That's a valid, absolutely valid concern. That's truly an export of capital because intellectual property is valuable. The issue is often the understanding of intellectual property as something intangible, and the geographical location of that and the way the Reserve Bank deals with it causes problems in industry. I'll give you an example where it might be problematic for a South African company to expand abroad because of the constraints of exchange control. My understanding of a trademark is that when you register a trademark, it's a negative right in a particular jurisdiction. So you have, let's say, somebody that's conducting a business like an estate agency, and they've got a very good recipe, a good business model, and they're very successful in South Africa, and they've got a valuable trademark. Now they want to go to, let's say, to a jurisdiction such as Spain, where there's lots of property being sold. And they go and set up a subsidiary, quite legitimately with the Reserve Bank's approval. They set up the subsidiary over there. And then they go and register the trademark for Spain in the name of their Spanish subsidiary. Now, the original act of registration establishes ownership. Now, the Reserve Bank would say, no, you can't do that because you're exporting capital. Now, we've come across a situation. Now, it's just one example where I think it doesn't reflect an understanding of what intellectual property is. Because in that situation in Spain, the intellectual property is being created in Spain for that jurisdiction. And it makes sense to be in that jurisdiction for protection purposes. It might make sense for treaty purposes. And it's still to the benefit of South Africa because the income from that subsidiary is a subsidiary of a South African company. Now, my general point is perhaps beyond the scope of the submissions here this morning is that there must be some sort of audit being done of why. And I don't have availability to statistics, but if somebody comes to South Africa, and it may be an issue of the availability of technical skill, it may be an issue of getting incentives by the government for that sort of thing, it may be a whole lot of factors. But why are other competing jurisdictions, such as, for example, Korea, more successful in having intellectual property being developed in their jurisdiction? And I just think, or India, for example, why is that? And look at those and come up with policies that address that issue. Now, I'm not saying exchange control is the end-all and be-all and the answer. I just think that it will be nice to align your exchange control with your incentives and with your tax legislation. Can I perhaps just try and answer some of the other questions that were raised with the Chair before I hand over to Mr. Kruger to answer the bulk of that? There was a question about on page 3 of our submission regarding the amendment, the definition to remove the exclusion of profits of a capital nature. I think the issue there is that prior to the introduction of capital gains tax, companies did sell capital assets and they made capital profits, which were obviously not taxable because we didn't have capital gains tax at the time, and then those proceeds would be reserves available for distribution. Now, there was a specific provision in the SEC legislation saying pre-capital gains tax regime profits, in other words, profits that accrue to you before the introduction of capital gains tax, when you distribute those profits, you're not going to pay SDC. It was a specific exemption. Now, there are companies that have those profits on their books. They've sold capital assets before October 2001, and if they declared it last year, they would have had an SDC exemption. Now, if the legislation now says that exemption is removed, suddenly now, when they declare this profit, it's still exactly the same factual circumstances, but that will now be subject to SDC. Now, I think that contains an element of retrospectivity in the way we've described here, because it now introduces CDT, SEC on something that wasn't subject to CDT, wasn't supposed to be subject to SEC in terms of their policy. Now, there may be specific examples that we've got in here that can illustrate the point to you. We've, right at the back of our submission, we deal with the, and it's been raised here before, I'm not going to raise it again, the retrospectivity of capital distribution legislation, which is the other retrospective component of the legislation. And we give an example there of a broad-based black economic empowerment trust acquired the shares of the company on loan account. And the company made a capital distribution to the trust before 1 July 2008. And then it's here further that the company applied the distribution partially towards paying off a loan. and distributed the remainder to its beneficiaries. The trust no longer has the funds to settle CGT respectively. Now, the same principle would apply here. Now, you've provided in your reserves that you're going to get this return for your shareholder based on the fact that the profit that you're going to declare the dividend from was not subject to CGT, and that you had this regime here. I don't see the rationale for now removing this exemption. And I just want to raise a general point about retrospectivity, whether it's inconvenience or whether it's a money issue. I think it's not a tax or inconvenience issue. I think it's almost a constitutional issue, in that it's a basic principle of legislation. There is an aversion to retrospective legislation in all legislative bodies. It's done very rarely and normally with great circumspection. I mean, you can't deny that there may be circumstances where retrospective legislation is justifiable. But they should be rare, and there should be a general aversion to retrospective legislation. The simple point being that if you're sitting here now, you know, with the tax laws on, with the laws of a company, laws of a country, you make decisions, important commercial decisions, to sit in with those. You do your tax planning. It's a fact of life. That I will advise a client that it's better to do it this way, legitimately, and it's legitimate, and it's the whole anti-avoidance covering me. My whole purpose is tax avoidance. To do it in a particular way to achieve a better overall result, tax-wise, but we get to the same commercial or business result. Now, that is based on the certainty of the law, because the law is the law. Now, if you have legislation coming a year later saying, no, the law is now deemed to be different at that point, it causes a whole range of problems. And I think there should be a great aversion to retrospectivity, and I think it's shared by the legislator. We just, by pointing out something retrospective, already puts a greater disadvantage to bring that legislation in. And then the point is it justified? And our point is it's not, our arguments are today not justified in these circumstances, and we detail that. Yeah, I hand over to Mr. Kruger to answer the rest.
I'm surprised the issue of the constitutionality of retrospectivity did not come from Mr. Kruger. When I was looking at the submission, I thought that would come up, but now that it has come up, but I'm not saying go to it, but respond to the remaining one.
Now, it is interesting that our fantastic constitution, which I reckon is probably one of the best in the world, doesn't specifically deal with this issue. And we would say that if you specifically, you as the legislators, provide for retrospectivity, that's fine, because you should be knowing what you're doing. And we just want to know, make sure that you know what you're doing when you do that. The difference between what I talk about backdated and retrospective, the retrospective legislation, you know, that Henny says is the law applied at that point in time is now being changed retrospectively. The minister got up in the budget this year and said that the SEC rate will reduce to 10% with effect from the 1st of October. When you pass the legislation incorporating a lot of the amendments that he has proposed, the reduction in tax rates for individuals, for instance, and a lot of other things, the change in SEC rate was not promulgated, which it should have done. What we have in sports at the moment is the minister saying that it will be 10% from 1 October. We have draft legislation that says it's 10% from 1 October, but we don't have law that says it's 1 October. So if I now counsel the SEC as a company at 10% today, I am doing it contrary to the law. And what I'm saying is we need certainty from SARS and National Treasury that is the way they're going to treat it. And that's all we need now. We need a note from them saying, yes, certainty, as they did recently with where there was a conflict in the effective tax rates for certain of the SEC legislation. So, as I said, the 10% thing is a backdated thing because it's effectively going to be backdated, but it's something that the minister anticipated in the future. So, in that sense, it's not retrospective. We can make that distinction. As regards to environmental deductions, if I can maybe just a bit of clarification from what Mr. Patel was saying. What we seem to be saying is when you look for depreciation on capital, so-called capital items, you ask yourself the question, how long will this capital item provide us with economic use? So, for instance, if you have a motor vehicle, they say you can ride it off over 4 years, 25% a year, because cars generally, after 4 years, you sell them and you move on or whatever. Similarly with plant machinery, it's over 3 years. Certain buildings over 20 years, etc. What we're saying is these items, the pumps, the filtration plants, the water dams, the reservoirs, are not things that are going to, they relate to rehabilitation. They are not going to endure longer than 10 years. And therefore, to make it 20 years sounds a bit crazy. So it's really linking it back and saying, what is the realistic write-off period for an asset? And these assets are defined in the legislation. We just highlighted a few things, but there is a definition. So we're not saying it's limited to these items. We're saying anything that now falls under this new dispensation, it should be 10%, not 5%, because generally these things will not endure for more than 10 years.
There was another question, why not 8, why not 15?
The sense is that it's 10 years. 10 years sounds like a good thing. It's like you'll say, okay, well, why wouldn't we provide for cars at 4 years, computers at 2 years, etc. I think it's probably Keith sits there with a glass of wine and decides, well, how long will this glass of wine take him to drink or whatever, but anyway. Yeah, so that's...
No, but the percentage.
Yeah. It's just on the basis that these things will not endure past 10 years. So you want to recoup the deduction over 10 years. 10 years, yeah. 10% a year, 10 years is written off 100%. And then just the final point about the retrospectivity, the question about the specific anti-avoidance provision that attacks genuine transactions. Is the example we give here where there's going to be apportionment of the capital when it is distributed, where effectively it's going to be done on a market value basis. So let's assume that you subscribe for a share for 1 rand and premium of 9, so you've got a share that you put capital of 10 in. I come along 10 years later and I subscribe for 1 rand share and premium of 20 or 19, so it's 20 and 10. If we return capital to us, they return 20 to me and 10 to you. The way the law reads at the moment, that doesn't give rise to any tax implications. Just the return of money I put in, the 20 rand I've put in, the 10 rand you put in. What this legislation seeks to do is to say, no, the market value of our shares is the same. Let's assume they're both 5 rand, worth 5 rand. So the 19 plus 9, 28 rand share premium and capital is now divided between us. Again, and to the extent that it's now divided, it's 50-50, I'm going to get 14 back as my arithmetic is correct, 14 and 50 back as share capital, whereas I've actually put in 20. That's a genuine transaction. It happens all the time. You have people who share buybacks on that basis, etc. This anti-avoidance provision is intended to attack the situation where you put in 10, I put in 20, the company takes your 10 and my 20 gives me 50 back, and there's no tax. Okay, but now the thing is, you've lost your 10. Somewhere in the future, you might have to be a dividend and pay STC. But there's been an absolute avoidance, if you can call it that, of tax. And we understand the mischief. The mischief is all the capital being distributed to one person. In terms of the new company law, Companies Act, in terms of Section 90 of the Companies Act, in the old days, you couldn't make a distribution unequally between shareholders. So if they were going to make a capital distribution to you and I, we had to be treated the same. So if there was going to be a capital distribution, you had to get your capital back, I had to get my capital back. Section 90 of the Companies Act now says you can make a capital distribution to anybody, provided you are solvent and liquid, after the distribution. So that's when somebody sat back and said, whoa, that's cool. I can take all the capital, give it to Des, and I don't have to charge him tax. And what SARS and National Treasury have realized is that this is a mechanism that is used to dispose of companies. You come in, you subscribe for shares, okay? That money is then taken and paid to me as a capital distribution. What's happened when you subscribe for shares, my value of my shares goes down, but I'm now going to get a capital distribution. So there's a mischief, and we don't have a problem around the mischief. But my problem is, far too often with specific anti-avoidance provisions, they do affect genuine transactions, and it's a huge, I used to be a draftsman, I know what it's like. It's very difficult to sometimes draft legislation to get to the mischief and not the genuine. And I think what we are being far too hesitant in saying we've got the general anti-avoidance rule. We spend a lot of time and effort on it. This committee spent a lot of time and effort on it. Let's use it. And that targets specific anti-avoidance provisions, and these are the genuine ones, if I can call it that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that brings us to the end of the session. And thank you very much, Maronix and BPO. A useful submission indeed. Thank you. We are now going to be taking... Our program says that the next is... it hasn't changed. It's actually the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law that comes now. I would want to recommend that you sit much closer, either here or where they were sitting. Because the committee members are sitting this side, and they would actually want to see, to see your faces when you raise some of these things, to evaluate the genuinity. not really. That lobbying session there, Prof, is It's illegal. It's forbidden in this committee. Yeah. The South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law is represented by Ms. Marilyn Kriege. Mr. Mohammed Kada. We unfortunately have a Mr. Mohammed Kamda in the room. So it's important that I say this quite clearly. Mr. Mohammed Kada. It doesn't mean that Mr. Mohammed can't make his own submission in his personal capacity. But I don't want the committee to confuse the two. Okay. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I begin, I assume that everybody has the written submission and I can refer to that.
Yes, the submission is titled GRLAB 21/2007. Members of college, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I thought that it would be important possibly for this committee to just understand what the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law was. And that's sort of set out in the background, and if there are any questions, obviously we will try and deal with those. But there are approximately 140 patent attorneys, patent agents, trademark practitioners who specialize in the field of intellectual property law, and it has become a very specialized area of law. And they have formed a body which tries to better protect and serve the interests of that particular interest group. We set up exams. We've been accredited by CETA to ensure general standards within the industry. And obviously, as intellectual property practitioners, we consulted by various clients, both international and local, on how best to protect the intellectual property and how best to exploit it. Our objection to the draft revenue law amendment bill, apart from the submission here, I know there's been a lot of certainly media coverage and also some coverage this morning, which I was fortunate to hear about the sort of idea about what intellectual property is and why this provision, certainly those relating to royalty payments and taxation, may not necessarily be good for South Africa. I'd also be happy to answer any of those questions if I can assist this committee in understanding the issues. But one of our primary objections today and which we'd like to deal with is the objection as far as it relates to counterfeit goods. Now, we'll all be aware that counterfeit goods comes, unfortunately, as rather a scourge to this country. And certainly we support the efforts that the Department of Trade and Industry has made to create fairly stringent laws to deal with counterfeit goods through the provisions of the Counterfeit Goods Act. That act has existed since 1997 and has been enforced. It was a long time coming, and a lot of drafting went into it to ensure that it complied with our international obligations in terms of the WTO and specifically TRIPS, which is the trade-related aspects of intellectual property law. That act specifically provides for a procedure to deal with counterfeit goods. And it was, at the time that it was put together, there is an advisory committee on intellectual property law and the DTI, and it's out of this body that the legislation came to us. And it has an interesting way of dealing with counterfeit goods, and you might think that these provisions are fairly stringent in their ambit, but the reason for that is that the Act can be fairly draconian if not properly enforced and the limitations aren't placed. And furthermore, in terms of TRIPS, there are requirements to make sure that the legislation is limited in its ambit. And those really mean, at the moment, how the Counterfeit Goods Act works is that, let's assume, and I'm going to concentrate on imported goods because the Revenue Amendments Act seeks to deal really with imported goods rather than those goods that are actually in South Africa. And what would happen is that Customs, the Department of Customs, because they're the custodians really, would note something coming into South Africa. There would be a Section 15 application already filed with them and in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act, which is an application to say, here are my intellectual property rights. The Counterfeit Goods Act only extends to certain intellectual property rights, being copyrights, trademarks, and prohibited marks in terms of the Merchandise Marks Act. And once you have lodged your Section 15 and it's been approved, SARS will then in its discretion, stop consignments which they believe may infringe on those rights. They would then let you know. You would have the opportunity to file on affidavit proof that, in fact, an intellectual property right has been infringed and that the goods are counterfeit. Now, there is, in terms of the counterfeit goods, the tests are slightly different. They're not intellectual property right. Proving that is the test for proving counterfeit goes beyond the test of just proving that you have an intellectual property right. At the moment, you usually have, 5 or 10 days from receipt of the sample to file the expert affidavit, and within a period after that, customs will approach through their legal department the courts to obtain a warrant for the seizure of the goods. So there's a very distinct difference made between detention, which has obviously always been within the ambit of these customs and revenue authorities, and then the seizure part, which is once it goes into either civil or criminal law, and that's why there's always this warrant procedure followed and a warrant obtained before the goods are actually seized. And that probably is also a good constitutional principle and following in line with the constitutional law. The procedures under the Act obviously are fairly onerous at the moment for IP holders in that they create, the onus is certainly on the IP holder to take action and to protect its rights. Obviously, it can rely on the resources of the South African Police Service to take criminal action, but the criminal justice system is under huge constraints, and it has very limited time periods with which to comply with. But we've learned to live with the Act as it stands. There also is, obviously, there have been many cases more recently decided about what the Counterfeit Goods Act says, and there have been more and more probably counterfeiters challenging the ambit of the Act, which is always good for development of case law. And specifically the case that I referred to on the second page of that submission is the Commission of South African Revenue Service, another, versus Sterling Auto Distributor CC. The importance of the case there is that the court went on to, and this is a TPD full bench decision, went on to decide that there was a very distinct difference between detention and then the seizure process, and that one needed to distinguish between the two and what happened during the detention process and what then happened during the seizure process. The court did say that the legislation would need to possibly look at clarifying that distinction, but it did no more than that. And I think I still agree with the comments made that clarification is necessary. Whether or not this new process, which has been introduced by Chapter XD, deals with that is what I'm here today to discuss with you. Right. Obviously, a law should try and correct or in some way deal with a mischief from a revenue perspective. And what the proposed amendments to Chapter XD try and do is, I suspect, take what is presently dealt with by the Counterfeit Goods Act and place it within the Revenue Act. Now, the reason for that I'm still trying to establish, and it isn't clear from the explanatory notes which have been provided with the piece of legislation. I believe it's to, from what I understand from the discussions that I've had, is that the World Customs Organization, of which South Africa is an extremely important member, in fact, Simon Gordon is the commissioner of that organization at present, has seen counterfeiting as a major problem and trying to look at better ways of dealing with the counterfeit problem. They have prepared a model law, which they have then given to all the countries and suggested to the countries they should enforce this law by changing their local customs law to help enforce the rights. The problem with that, of course, is that South Africa is a unique country. We already have a fairly strong Counterfeit Goods Act, which deals with the obligations of the customs authorities within that ambit. And one questions why one's now removing, and we haven't removed it, and that's the question as well. We simply have a proposal to amend the revenue laws, but no similar proposal to amend the Counterfeit Goods Act. So this is where we now have a conflict of law, and that is never good for any country's governance. Just to briefly go through the provisions in Chapter XB, a right holder must now apply to the commissioner to detain the goods under customs control which are suspected of infringing the right holder's intellectual property rights. That's under Section 78B. And this procedure seems to be a duplication of what already exists under Section 15 of the Counterfeit Goods Act. Now, the procedure on how that process will be addressed could obviously be regulated by regulations, but there are no regulations. So I have to now again look at this law in isolation and say, well, I've got one process dealing with it under the Counterfeit Goods Act, and now I've got a new law which will come into force under the Customs and Excise Act, and which one should I follow? Because the procedure is in fact not the same, and the requirements under both sections is not identical. My onus is much more stringent under Section 15 than it is under the proposed amendment. The officer will then, being the on-the-ground customs officer, will examine goods entering the country, and if he has a reasonable cause to believe that the goods are not genuine or prima facie counterfeit, he must, in terms of the application under 78B, detain the goods. The process at the moment is that when he has a reasonable suspicion that counterfeiting has happened, and here he has to apply his mind a little bit more stringently, he has to first establish, is there intellectual property right? Has there been an act of counterfeiting? And do I have an act of importing? Before then saying, prima facie, I believe that there is an offence here, and I'm arranging to send a sample to the right holder who has lodged the appropriate Section 15 application to then decide whether or not these goods are counterfeit. So the onus would also change under this, and I'm not sure that the onus is that the change in onus, so that customs officers do not, they only simply have to look that there is an intellectual property right before detaining goods, is necessarily a good one from a good governance point of view. Upon detention of the goods, the officer must inform the right holder of the import consignee of the detention and furnish the right holder with a sample of the goods. That process is no different. The distinction, however, comes in, and it's dealt with later, but I might as well deal with it now, in the time periods which apply. At the moment, what happens is the detention is effected, a detention notice under 113 capital A is issued, and a sample is arranged to be sent to the right holder, usually through their attorney's offices in South Africa, because many of these right holders may be foreign proprietors. That sample is arranged to be collected, usually by the right holder, at its expense and using courier services or the most convenient method. With the best will in the world, I can assure you that Vicebridge, which is some way from Messina and where there's only a courier company in Messina, it takes 2 days to get it back to Messina and back to Pretoria, where I am situated. If the attorney's firm was situated in Cape Town, it would take at least 3 days. That's 3 days already of your 10-day period. There's no provision made in the amendments for extensions, and that's one of our submissions. At the moment, the periods are calculated 10 days from receipt of the sample, which would make perfectly logical sense. You then all have, it's equal playing field. If it takes you 3 days or 5 days to get the sample, you all have 10 days to analyze it. Extensions are obviously then always allowed on reasonable grounds. That's the principle of our law. Where the right holder wants to institute criminal proceedings, he must do so once he's filed his expert affidavit and that the goods have then been seized. Now, everything in the Counterfeit Goods Act hinges from this notice, which is called the Section 7(1)(d) notice, which is your seizure notice. Now, that seizure notice can only be issued once there's actually been a warrant issued to effect the seizure. The process now is that you simply, by way of letter, have to let the customs officer know that these goods are counterfeit, and then within a further 10-day period, bring an application to court. Now, the word they use in the draft is application. In law, that has a very, very specific meaning, and it means actually on notice of motion supported by affidavit evidence, rather than bringing possibly a summons proceeding. Again, we're dealing with a lot of foreign proprietors who own rights in this country, and to try and get a commissioned and appropriately signed affidavit from Barbados is probably going to take us more than 3 or 4 days to draft, and certainly more than the 10 days to get back here. So I'm suggesting that the time periods as they prepare to, if it's going to only be an application and not other, any type of civil proceedings would be inappropriate. The right holder must apply to court to determine that the goods, and the word used must, that the goods are counterfeit, and the word counterfeit goods has the meaning others under the Counterfeit Goods Act. Now what this means is if you decide, and the provision is made under these amendments, to apply to proceed criminally. If you proceed criminally, no time periods for some reason apply. And I imagine that's because we now need to jump back into the Counterfeit Goods Act, although it's not clear because the legislation hasn't been clear on this point. But the problem is that you must bring an application to court in order to declare these goods to be counterfeit goods. So even if you were to settle the matter, as often these matters are, the goods must be returned if no action is no application is brought to court to the person from whom the goods were seized or detained. That person is known as the affected party under the definition of the Act. That again creates difficulties. Why should it go back to that affected party, especially if settlement would be an appropriate way to deal with a matter? And court orders today aren't necessarily always obtained under the Counterfeit Goods Act as it presently stands. The goods must then be removed to a counterfeit goods depot. At the moment, the goods are moved to a counterfeit goods depot. The Counterfeit Goods Act says as soon as reasonably possible. Under this provision, it says that if you don't remove them within no later than one day after the date of the notice of detention, SARS will help you to move them at your expense. Now, unfortunately, Customs has no jurisdiction over those counterfeit goods depots at the moment. They are declared by DTI, they are administered by DTI, and now it appears that Customs can control the counterfeit goods depots, order the person who's in charge of these depots to deliver up or not to deliver up the goods. And it appears that there is a lacuna in these provisions in that it really doesn't have the authority or power to do so. We've said that it conflicts for various reasons. The definition of right holder under the Counterfeit Goods Act is not the same definition as under these new proposed amendments. The procedure envisaged at detention and then continues indefinitely. And that is a problem, I think, because the courts have already decided that detention and seizure are two very distinct processes. It now appears that if goods are imported and are detained by customs, that detention continues indefinitely. And although I may comply with all the time periods which apply under these new proposals, in fact, as we will all know, it could take you 2.5 to 3 years to get into court while a detention still continues. There should have been a seizure and a seizure under proper legal process. I'm of the view that the Counterfeit Goods Act and the procedure set out there under would be appropriate to deal with these matters. The effective seizure of the counterfeit goods is conducted without a warrant or any subsequent confirmation of the seizure, as is prescribed by the Counterfeit Goods Act, as I've set out now, and the right holder may initiate such seizure by means of writing a simple letter without proving what his rights are and why he says these goods are counterfeit. The goods have to be moved to the counterfeit goods depot on the initial detention of the goods and not only once the goods are seized. So what we're also having is a situation where SARS may, or customs officer may, detain goods. He cannot make any assessment of the goods and decide whether or not they are counterfeit. But the right holder, who now still has 10 days to make that decision, has already got to move the goods to a counterfeit goods depot when in fact those goods may not be counterfeit. And it just seems that that maybe this provision hasn't been given sufficient consideration. The Counterfeit Goods Act provides for a criminal complaint to be lodged in 3 days after the date of the seizure notice. There's no provision now. It simply says you can proceed criminally. Again, the reason for the three-day provision and its other time periods is, again, to comply with the TRIPS agreement. And arguably, this new provision may not be fully TRIPS compliant. And we obviously have our international treaties to look to. We have signed them, and we are required to abide by as signatories to those agreements. Reference is only made to an application to court, as I've mentioned, and whereas procedures in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act are not limited to applications only. I think that may have just been a drafting error. Maybe they meant to say proceedings. No provision is made for the right holder to be able to lodge a criminal complaint only. So under the Counterfeit Goods Act at the moment, you may decide only to proceed criminally. That would be a legitimate process. Once the goods have been seized, the goods remain seized until such time as a criminal court has then made an order, or a civil court, or both. Under 78D5, it's contemplated that goods on request of the commissioner must be released from the counterfeit goods depot to the affected party. Customs has no control over these depots, as I've mentioned, and an order from them is not necessarily something that can be enforced unless he intends to now bring actions against these parties. They're not under his control or his jurisdiction. Obviously, it's our view that the provisions are problematic, and it's possible that it's very difficult for us to really properly assess these provisions, because while we've been told, not by DGI, but only by SARS, that there will be amendments to the Counterfeit Goods Act, no such amendments have been tabled. We don't know what those amendments are going to look like. And my concern is also that even if these pass in a form where it is only to be promulgated at a future date, once the Counterfeit Goods Act has been amended, there is no doubt in my mind that these provisions are going to require further amendment. And the question then is, are we not wasting this committee's time at the moment to consider these if possible further amendments are going to be necessary? And lastly, the Counterfeit Goods Act, we submit that the amendments to the Act will conflict with the Counterfeit Goods Act insofar as, for example, a right holder be required to bring proceedings in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act without the various procedural requirements of the Act being met. And it's still not certain what the provisions will entail for right holders, because they'll not know whether they're in the Counterfeit Goods Act or whether they're in the Customs Amendment Act, or the Customs Act is then amended. One of the other issues which we've raised, simply as an aside, is the time period. And we simply believe that, and I've set it out there, often these people who can sign these affidavits and who can only testify to the originality or not of the goods are sitting overseas. Let's take a good example of a Nokia or a Motorola cell phone. The technology in those phones is so sophisticated that neither you or I would be able to tell, looking at the outer cover of it, whether or not it's the original counterfeit. Often these have to be sent off overseas for testing and analysis, and a reasonable extension would only be granted as reasonable by our courts, and we'd have to show good cause why an extension would be granted. There's no provision made for any extensions or proposals that extensions will be agreed to. And again, it seems that in terms of the new provisions, SARS now will be responsible for dispatching the samples to us and making sure they get to us. And my concern is that we'd still be required to comply with those 10-day periods to ensure that we take the necessary action. If I can just then make the two comments, I know that there's been some comments made already about the royalty payments and amendments and what it means for intellectual property law. For those on the committee who may not necessarily understand, intellectual property law is a very wide, from a legal perspective, ambit of various rights. Trademarks would what you most of you would know as your brand. Your copyright is a little bit more complicated, and that right extends to artistic works, literary works, the face of the cover of the CD, the music that's played, sound recordings, a variety of rights. Then there's the patent, which is colloquially explained as the inventor step, what's actually inside the product which makes it work. And then you have the design, which is the look and feel of that particular product. Take, for example, a toaster or your vacuum cleaner. That look or feel would probably be design protected. Those rights all tend to overlap. And then there's confidential knowledge and trade secrets. The trade secret, for example, would be something in the order of the Coca-Cola formula. All right. The problem with all of these rights is that they do hang together, and they have become an incredibly important part in our modern-day economy. If any of you have seen press reports, you will see that Microsoft values 90% of its value of its business is in intellectual capital, including intellectual property, and only 10% in its actual physical assets. And as we move in more into the information age, intellectual property is what is important for a business to grow, thrive, and develop. Taking that into account, as a new emerging economy which is trying to improve the access to technology and improve our ability to compete on the international stage, if we have laws which from a revenue perspective try to tax and discourage local investment, it cannot be good for our economy. Take for example the prevention of use of local expertise. Now, we have local expertise in this country, for example, developing molds. In terms of the revenue amendment as it stands, there would be no incentive to instruct a local design company to design a new headlight for your vehicle or a new mold for your packaging, all right? Because that intellectual property would now be resident-based taxed in South Africa. You'd never be able to export it. We live in a global economy. Global players, you want to be able to take it overseas. Now, I understand the mischief when all intellectual capital is taken out of the country. But the problem arises in that we are legislating not necessarily for the mischief, but we're legislating for everything. So we're touching everything with the same brush, stroke, and we're destroying the ability to, in our view, invest in intellectual property and the creation of intellectual capital in this country. The other last aspect is the prevention of licensing. If a South African company is appointed as a licensee, it will normally be required to create engineering drawings to enable it to manufacture the goods locally. What a license agreement would do is usually it would say, you, Mr. X, you have the license to manufacture this. You pay us a royalty for what you manufacture and sell at an approved rate. That would always have to go through exchange control approval, and they are very defensive of what is acceptable as a royalty. At the moment, I don't think you get away with more than 5 to 7% at the maximum, sometimes slightly more, but you'd have to show very good grounds for a higher royalty. Well, the copyright works for intellectual property that would be created, if only to a limited extent. The licensee would then be subject to the punitive tax provisions and presumptions, as though it was responsible for the original development of the licensed technology. A foreign company cannot grant a license to a local business without this risk, making licensing to local companies and the resulting importation of technology for local skills development undesirable. And I think that's an additional concern that we should be looking into. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I thought it was a short presentation. Looking at the hard copy. But it just shows how much was actually buried in it. Questions? Quickly, members, we've actually now gone over time. I thought we were going to be able to do within our time limit. Mr. Singh, Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. A very quick question. I'm not surprised that there are 140 patent attorneys and agents and trademark practitioners. And after having listened to what the Counterfeit Goods Act is all about and what happens and what doesn't happen. But I don't know, this question may be out of order. Just to find out, do her members just to get an idea of, how many cases do you all deal with counterfeit goods and what's your approach to submission, and just one or two examples and the success rate in overturning some of the definition of the goods as being counterfeit.
In actual fact, it is not.
It's not so.
It is. Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the submission. I think it was incredibly interesting, although it's been incredibly technical from your legal perspective. And I must admit that, to a certain extent, you have answered a previous question of mine, maybe better for my understanding than what the others were supposed to do. I just want to find out, first of all, the whole thing about motor cars, imported motor cars, does that fall under this as well? Because, I mean, they get detained and seized as well. Then I want to find out, surely one would expect that there must be enough proof for a reasonable doubt whether a product is counterfeit or not, or illegal in that sense or not. What is that onus, and on who is that, and on who are that onus to determine that, if that is the case? Because surely there's a lot of justification for trying to prevent counterfeit goods and illegal goods to be imported and distributed. But surely there's also an enormous lot of legal stuff going on, and people that is law-abiding citizens and people that is doing it legally. Now, I mean, if anyone can just, by merely the fact that that might be an imported product, and we're not sure whether that's legal or not, just go and detain that. It's a really huge problem. I know that when we have discussed the annual report of SARS, they made mention of the number of vehicles that has been detained, and those that was justified cases eventually. So that's a huge difference. So to what extent, whilst we're doing what we must do to protect the economy, but we must also protect the law-abiding citizens and companies that is doing it legally. You can just elaborate on that for me. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You know, in Parliament, there's a tradition that in the chamber, members are allowed time for statements before they ask a question. And I'm going to begin to restrict that privilege for members in the committee, because you know, time does not, because I don't monitor members' time to say, I'm giving you a second to answer a question. So, members, beware. The rules are going to change a bit. Ms. Fabs?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just 3 points here. As we went through this, which I must say was very explanatory, but still left one or two questions here for me. It would seem to be that one of the core questions or concerns is around the whole time factor, on the one hand, in these processes. And that is also partly related to the Customs and Excise Act and the Counterfeit Goods Act. The second issue that I'm looking at here is it would appear to be the draft conflation of detention and seizure, or detention that would amount to seizure, as it were, because, again, the length of time involved in the processing. The third thing here, and then this, therein would come my question, I didn't really see the one on licensing, the last point that you made, so I may well have just lost track of where I was. But the question then related to the first one, you spoke about the interest in ensuring that the economy grew, etc., and the contribution of intellectual property, etc., to this. And you made mention then of the example of paper bags and that kind of thing. We do the design here, register it here, and then this could prove to be problematic later when we wanted to export, if I'm not mistaken, the design, or establish a factory to make that. What is going to be problematic? I'm just trying to get a grip on the problem that you were referring to then, related to what I saw as the export of capital in relation to intellectual property. Thank you.
Thanks. You were almost the first victim of the new rules. Can we get quick responses in the remaining 60 seconds?
Right, I'll try and limit myself to no comments. Can I start with the last one? The problem is that the incentive to develop
intellectual property in South Africa would not be there. Short and sweet. The second issue is the owner. You talked about cars. Cars are slightly different. We're really talking about parts and accessories, although whole phones and whole cars being entirely counterfeit have been known to be created. But I will say customs is generally quite careful when it looks at goods coming to this country. We only check, do a physical inspection, SARS might not give you these figures, of less than 2% of containerized cargo. So it's, but they do what they call profiling on the documents, etc. You know, if it's called an XYZ candle company and they're importing, according to the documents, Motorola or cell phones, they'd probably have a look at it. Okay. Time factor. The time factor obviously is an important issue, but we've learned to live with short time periods. That's not the issue. It's that there is this confusion between what we're now supposed to do. Are we supposed to use these... Let's assume that they come into force as they are. Are we supposed to deal with a detention, or are we supposed to be using the Counterfeit Goods Act? There seems to be an entire conflict between the two provisions, and that's my major concern. The time periods I will live with, if the time periods as they exist in this proposed amendment go through, they create an additional problem in that there is no opportunity to get extensions. And although in practice at the moment we get them all the time, provided we can show good cause. It's a generally accepted legal principle. I think if that's... Oh, 90.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That, that was useful, quite attractive, insightful information. We'll hear when we get responses from SARS and National Treasury. And I'll call upon the non-profit consortium.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Where are you? Non-profit organization. In fact, I would have preferred that you come forward, but in the interest of time, I think you're quite visible where you are.
Thank you.
I'm told here that it's Mr. Peter Henrik.
That's correct.
That's you, and then Mr. Ricardo Wenger.
That's correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. First, we want to thank the committee for this opportunity. And just indicate that we will be concentrating on or raising the objection in respect of the removal of exemption from skills development levy for public benefit organizations as contemplated by the receipt of revenue. We have submitted our documents, and I just want to ensure that it's available to all the members. In fact, there are a few corrections. Thank you. There are a few corrections in that way. We refer to section 4D on pages 2 and 3. We're actually referring to section 4C of the skills development levy.
So where you say we propose that existing 4D, you actually mean 4C?
4C, that's correct.
And the other one, on the same page, nature of, in order for an organization to qualify for the exemption under 4D,
it should actually be
should also change to C.
Yeah. And the paragraph above that.
And the paragraph?
Above that as well. We propose the existing section.
Yeah, we started with that. Okay. So all the 4Gs are actually 4Cs. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Section 4C provides that certain public benefit organizations would be exempted from having to pay the skills levy. Specifically, it refers to those organizations that solely carry on and any public benefit activity contemplated in paragraph 1, 2A, B, C, and D, and 5 of part 1 of the 9th schedule to the Income Tax Act. And then also those organizations that solely provide funds to public benefit organizations contemplated in subparagraph 1. Now, these exemptions are extremely, exemption is extremely important to public benefit organizations, considering the nature of these organizations. I think the nature would best be considered if one has a look at Section 30 of the Income Tax Act, which provides that it must carry on its activities in a non-profit manner and with an altruistic or philanthropic intent. And then it also provides that no such public benefit activity is intended to directly or indirectly promote the economic self-interest of any fiduciary or employee of the organization, otherwise than by way of reasonable remuneration payable to that fiduciary or employee. And then three, each public benefit activity carried on by that organization is for the benefit of or is widely accessible to the general public at large, including any sector thereof, other than small and exclusive groups. And then four, it is prohibited from directly or indirectly distributing any of its funds to any person otherwise than in the course of undertaking any public benefit activity, and is required to utilize its funds solely for the object for which it has been established. Now, it's our submission that the Section 4C should be retained in its existing format and should not be amended at all. So as the reason for the proposed amendment, which is to delete this paragraph 4C, is that the proposed amendment will give effect to the proposal in the 2006 budget review, but having a look at the 2006 budget review, where it doesn't seem to apply, and in fact, I also view that is an area in 2007, which is more applicable.
So is that why you have the 7 in bracket? Otherwise,
it is aimed at placing public benefit organizations on par with other employers regarding the payment of skills development levy. Now, this also translates into a benefit for public benefit organizations, and the benefit obviously relies on the fact that it does not have to physically pay any of its much needed funds towards the skills development levy, and yet retain the benefit that its employees have access to this fund. For example, we see that the facet seeker says, despite the fact that employers of organizations that have been exempted does not contribute, a certificate can be issued to these type of employers and these employees would still be able to participate even though there's no contribution. Now, it's important to point out to the committee that public benefit organizations are deserving of this benefit in light of the broader public benefit ensuing from the activities. Now, on page 3 of our submission, paragraph D, we highlight and I'm going to read, public benefit organizations have been exempted from the Skills Development Levy Act since its inception, precisely because of the activities being directed for the benefit of the broader public. Since 1994, the non-profit sector in South Africa continues to fulfill a vital, multidimensional role in strengthening democracy, promoting economic development, advocating for changes in government policy, and delivering a range of welfare services to poor and marginalized communities. Now, this removal of the exemption would have a significant impact on public benefit organizations, and for this purpose, I wish to point to the table on page 4 of our document submitted, where one can have a view of the number of employees within the non-profit sector, and it's quite clear that it employs more full-time employees, including volunteers and part-time employees, compared to the full-time employees in the mining sector in South Africa.
there seems to be a problem with the slide on that table 1 on page 4. I was just checking here with my administration, and it is said that even on the original one, this information was not clear.
Either. Oh, our apologies.
Can we be finished with a much more clearer one?
We will.
So if you've got one here, we can always just make copies just of page 4.
Sorry, I only got this one here. My apologies, but I can make copies available.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Okay, if you can read them now, but then we'll also have copies.
Yep.
Because if that's the only copy you have, because if you had two, you would be talking to the other one while you make copies of the picture.
Okay. My apologies for that.
Okay, but can you just read them out so that we know what's in the columns?
It's important to point out, though, that this is studies done in 2001, which was published in 2002, and since the sector has grown, full-time employees, the number of employees in 2001, 305,011, and it constituted 47% of the total employees in the non-profit sector. Then there was part-time employees, which was 23,314, constituting 4%. Then there was volunteers, which constituted 316,991,000, which constituted 49%. Now, although not all of these employees are not employed at approved public benefit organizations, it is clear that a substantial number of public benefit organizations may be affected by the proposed amendment to the Skills Development Levies Act. For example, a public benefit organization with an annual payroll of about $2 million, which is currently exempted from paying the Skills Development Levy, will have to make provision for an additional amount of 20,000 rand to cover for the Skills Development Levy. Now, to some, 20,000 rand may sound a little, but for non-profit organizations, it is a substantial amount of money. Now, the current proposal does not take into account the fact that there are other organizations that is described in Section 4 of the Skills Development Act that would still benefit from it. For example, Section 4 provides for further exemption for public service employers in the national or provincial sphere of government. Another mistake on paragraph 3 under further exemptions, before the word any should be the word and as well. And any national or provincial public entity, page 3, underlining further exemptions, paragraph F.
Paragraph F?
Yes, that's correct.
Where is the correction there?
It should be the second line on paragraph F, after the word government, and
right.
between the word government and any, the word and should be inserted there. Our apologies.
Oh, or sphere of government.
And
any national or provincial public entity.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, if 80% or more of its expenditure is defrayed directly or indirectly from funds voted by Parliament and certain municipalities. So we see there are organizations, government organizations, that would still benefit from it. Then, we also note that Section 4B refers to employees with a payroll, and that is also on the table to be amended to increase that amount from 250,000 rand to 500,000 rand. And I read, in addition to above, small businesses are also exempted through Section 4B in situations where the total amount of remuneration paid or payable by that employer to all its employees during the following 12-month period will not exceed 500,000 rand. This benefit exemption is accessible to qualifying public benefit organizations. However, we submit that it is not an equivalent substitute for the existing Section 4C, as many of the current exempted public benefit organizations' payroll would exceed the limit of 500,000. And it's important to draw the distinction here between public benefit organizations and other organizations that is for profit. With paying their levy,
other organizations as for-profit can recover the cost of paying that that amount. Public benefit organizations rely exclusively on funding. There is no talk about cost recovery in that respect. It is however noteworthy to consider the reason offered by the South African Receiver of Revenue in support of increasing the current limit of 500,000 from 250,000 for other employers. And I'm going to read. Currently, a business with a payroll of less than 250 rand per annum and which does not have any employees who are liable for pay is exempt from the payment of skills levy as part of the initiative to provide relief for small businesses and to reduce the compliance costs. The Minister of Finance proposed in his budget review this year that the threshold for the exemption from the skills development levy be increased to 500,000 rand. The requirement of not having any employees liable for pay will also be deleted. Now, I want to highlight that it is as part of the initiative to provide relief for small business and to reduce the compliance costs. Now, that was the motivation, was small businesses, and public benefit organizations found themselves excluded then from this considering their objective. Now, there is no substantial motivation offered for this amendment. In fact, according to SARS, the reason for the proposed change is simply to give effect to the proposal in the 2006 budget review aimed at placing public benefit organizations on par with other employees regarding the payment of skills development levy. Now, we also view that public benefit organizations cannot be placed on par with other small businesses, or businesses for that matter. And because of the impact that this proposal has, we also view that a more substantial motivation should be offered in this regard. The current proposal provides the removal of an existing tax benefit offered to public benefit organizations. The proposed amendment has its origins in an unsubstantiated motivation which should not be used as a basis to provide for the removal of a significant tax benefit that has been offered to public benefit organizations since the inception of this Act. Now, if there's any other questions, me and my colleague would be willing to answer.
So the only time you involve your colleague is when they're questioned. That's what you said. Okay, thank you very much, MPC. We've had from Mr. Hendricks questions from members and comments. I don't want members to crave for questions. If you don't have questions, just behave yourself. Okay, thank you, MPC. It was an intervention. I was looking at members and I could see that they didn't have questions.
Yeah.
But, you know, a politician that would actually formulate a question, and it happens a number of times. We break for tea for 10 minutes, but I want to take this opportunity to thank all of the people that have made submissions, written and otherwise. Especially those that came with oral submissions. We have benefited from a lot of submissions you have made, and we trust that next Australia, when they respond, that will further enrich our understanding of the issues involved, and we will take it from there. We are taking responses from National Treasury according to our program on Wednesday, the 24th. That's next week, Wednesday. And then the committee will take a decision as to when we will then formally consider this amendment. Thank you very much. We'll break for 10 minutes and then we'll come back. And the next session is going to be a closed session where we are going to be doing a quick preparation for our engagement with the Financial Services Board on Tuesday next week. That shouldn't take longer than 30 minutes. And I know there are members that would want to catch flights, and I'm not going to allow them to leave because they ask questions that actually delay them. So they are going to wait until we are done. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your cooperation, but thank you very much. Thanks, Nathan Sugar, and thanks, Mark, and thanks, everyone.